Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and as most of you would know or may have noticed, over the last week or so, there has been mounting speculation that the US government is getting serious about preparing charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The question is, could these charges threaten press freedom? Joining us to discuss that this week is Lawfare's Managing Editor, Susan Hennessy. That's a very interesting conversation. This week's show is brought to you by Senatas. Senatas makes Layer 2 encryption equipment, but today they're joining us to talk about some work they're doing with ADVA Optical Networks in marrying their tech with some software-defined networking stuff done at a telco level. And the end result is actually pretty interesting. You can drop a virtualized encryptor at your border that plays nicely with, you know, this whole SDN setup. It's a nice way of handling encryption when it comes to software-defined networks. We'll hear more about that later. But before we get into all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, it seems someone might be having a bit of fun with some of the dumped NSA tools, some of the Shadow Brokers tools, but it's a little bit difficult to get a handle on the scale of the issue.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of reporting about people who've been doing scans for various bits of the NSA toolchain that got released in the Shadow Brokers dump, and in particular the kind of first stage in-memory loader, which is called Double Pulsar, which you can kind of fingerprint over the network. And yeah, some people have been running scans for that, and we've seen numbers, you know, in excess of 100,000 machines running this kind of first stage loader thing. And, you know, other people have come up with numbers that are, you know, more like 10,000. It's a little bit confusing. There's been a couple of implementations of tooling to check whether or not a particular machine's running it, and maybe there was a bug in some of the tooling, but it's all, yeah, it's been rather confusing. But whatever the case is, at least some boxes out there on the internet have been owned, you know, with this particular, or have this particular first stage loader running on them, and who knows what else as a result. And yeah, if it's 100,000, you know, I'm not sure I would be super surprised. I mean, those tools presumably have been kicking around in private circles for a while. And of course, anyone who got the dumps early and acted on some of the older machines, you know, where the bugs weren't patched out, you know, it's not unreasonable you would have owned 100,000 machines.
Yeah, so which machines does this actually affect? I mean, this is their SMB thing, right? So it's only going to affect machines with SMB exposed to the internet, which I'm guessing were probably owned by, you know, MSO 067, 08, 067, like a while ago.
So Double Pulsar is the first stage implant, and actually it, as it was in the leak, it's actually able to, it runs in ring zero in kernel and has like a sort of a port knocking process where it uses unused bits of the protocol or kind of reserved bits of SMB protocol messages to kind of trigger its response back. So the packets coming in can come in and look like regular SMB or in fact RDP. You can run Double Pulsar on 3389 as well, and it has a similar mechanism. So yeah, it's not only SMB, although it has been kind of reported like that, but it's a generic kind of first stage, and you could use it with other bugs if you so desired.
Yeah, but I mean, my point is these aren't particularly well protected machines, shall we say.
No, I mean, the chances are that they are machines that were not patched up to date and they got owned with, you know, Eternal Blue or one of the other bugs that got dropped, and then Double Pulsar is the payload. And then, yeah, they're sitting there waiting for further instructions. And indeed, they may have been, you know, issued further instructions. There was the pitch impair was the kind of second stage, more full-featured implant that was in the Shadow Brokers dump. So, yeah, you would use Double Pulsar to kind of bootstrap pitch impair. We had a great demo, actually, of all this NSA tooling in our kind of like Friday beer things last week after listeners would have heard.
This is how Adam has fun, everyone. He sits here, he crack a beer and, you know, use some NSA tooling. That's sounds like fun, actually.
Mark Piper, who talked on the show last week about some of the aspects of the tooling, yeah, he gave us all a bunch of demos of the various tools, you know, owned Windows boxes and Double Pulsar them and pitch impaired them using Fuzz Bunch and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Were there golf claps?
Yeah, rather. I mean, it's, you know, it's rather funny for us old school, you know, hackers who've always been in the private sector to, you know, sit around, drink a beer and you know, play with the NSA's tooling from, you know, 2003 AD or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's another story here on ours which says that someone's come up with some tooling that can remotely actually remove this thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of the Five Eyes tooling has the ability to self-destruct or to auto-destruct after a period of time or to remove itself on command, because obviously not being detected is one of their key things. And I mean, the fact that it's taken this long for their tools to get, you know, really thoroughly dumped, you know, suggests that it does work well. But yeah, people have written up some tooling to remove it. Although in this case, I mean, Double Pulsar is like an in-memory first stage only. So even just rebooting the box would get rid of it. I mean, the real problem is that you're not patched against whatever bug initially owned
it. Yeah, it's just going to come back. It's code red syndrome, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're running a Windows 2003 box on the internet, you're going to keep having a bad time for the rest of time. And, you know, one good Samaritan, you know, uninstalling Double Pulsar remotely isn't really going to help you.
Now, you remember when it used to be that you would do a V4 like Nmap scan to find just specific ports that corresponded to certain attack tools, right? Like 31337 for back RFS. 12345 was Netbus. And just, you know, this is just, you know, showing my age a bit here. But I remember one scan throwing up a lot of 12345s. This is a long time ago. And it turned out the reason was that Trend Micro, in its infinite wisdom, had actually put a management service for its products on port 12345.
Oh, bless.
Yeah, I bless know, right? Hearts. I know, right? Yep. Oh, now, endpoint security company Tanium found itself in a little bit of trouble over the last week when the Wall Street Journal ran a story that alleged they had been using unauthorized access to a customer network, which happened to be a hospital, to do like sales demos and were showing like internal IPs and all sorts of sensitive network information, maybe even some patient information on the screens in order to sell their shiny endpoint security product. It looks like they've kind of said, oh, well, you know, this was actually the customer's demo network, not their real network, but the hospital hasn't really done much to clear that up. And it's really not 100% sure. We're not really 100% sure what's happened here, except I think we can say pretty confidently that whatever happened, it wasn't kosher.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the hospital has basically said that they were a previous vendor and they had some access. It doesn't look like this, you know, sort of using their, I mean, the Tanium guy said that it was their demo, the hospital's demo environment. Hospital doesn't really say what it is, but either way, it did not appear that there was any kind of formal agreement for this to happen. And the hospital is saying that they didn't intend them and that no patient data was leaked or exposed. And, you know, everyone's kind of pointing the finger every direction.
Yeah, well, staying with vendors behaving badly, and I love it when this happens because it does happen quite a lot. Webroot apparently just started nuking all sorts of legit files and bricking computers and just, you know, generally going haywire. I think Sophos was the last one that decided, you know, System 32 was some horrible APT and started nuking it, right? But it's happened again. Webroot, walk us through this one.
Yeah, so now Webroot's an antivirus vendor of some sort. I had never actually heard of them before this, but apparently they are. And yeah, they issued a bung update that marked a whole bunch of stuff that's, you know, kind of core Windows components and core application components as malware and quarantined it, thus breaking the boxes. And then, apparently they are having trouble like pushing out an update or something for it as well. Like, I'm not sure whether the update mechanism was broken by the whatever they it decided to quarantine, but either way, it really sounds very, very bad for both them and their customers.
And I know that there would be people listening to this who've been affected by this, but it's just, and it hurts them. Do you know what I mean? It hurts them. It's unfair to them and it's not something that they will be laughing about, but there's something about seeing vendors fall on their face like this that I just makes me chuckle, you know? Like, do you know what I mean? I feel guilty about it now that I'm older, but it's still just like, damn.
Yeah, I mean, I guess AV vendors are the butt of many of our jokes in the industry because they are, you know, sort of old world solutions to problems that are, you know, seem to many of us long past. But yeah, it's kind of, you're right. I probably shouldn't laugh, but I totally was.
Yeah, exactly. Brickabot, we spoke about this last week. This is the botnet that permanently disables IoT devices that are capable of being mirrored. Apparently someone's giving it a good run at the moment. It's back with a vengeance.
Yeah, there's been a couple more variants since we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It's, you know, same kind of MO. There's some boxes behind Tor that are going around owning IoT things and, yeah, like removing their partition tables, zero-filling the disks and rebooting them, which, yes, dead and gone. The Bleeping Computer was actually running an interview with one of the guys or the guy who claims to be behind it. It's kind of uncorroborated whether he actually is or not, but anyway, the guy is asserting that his name is Janitor with a zero, which is, you know, I guess, and he's cleaning the internet of bots to kind of thin out the population of things that are going to get DDoSed or be used in Mirai-style DDoS, which, I mean, I guess it's an engineering solution.
That's what we speculated on last week, whether or not the person doing it was considering it a, you know, form of public service, and I guess they are, right? Whether or not that's a good way to serve the public interest is another question, but...
Well, yes, but...
Yeah, but you
know, it's an engineering solution. Whether or not it's a good solution, I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Krebs on Security has his write-up of the sentencing of this guy, Roman Selesnev, who has just been sentenced to 27 years in prison in the United States for, you know, cybercrime. What is the story behind this? Because Krebs hints that, you know, there is a story and there is maybe a justification for this sentence, which is, you know, you get less for murder. Let's face it.
Yeah, so Krebs has got a bunch of the backstory, I guess, about this guy and his position in some of the carding and, carding and cracking forums. Apparently, he was behind one of the break-ins to a big restaurant chain to get card skimming data and had been running, a number of card skimming operations, selling skimmed, you know, track data and credit card data on various forums for a number of years. Was using his connections inside the Russian, you know, police and FSB, etc., to kind of avoid arrest. His father is a prominent member of the Russian Duma. So, yeah, there's been, sort of a number of aspects, I guess, in terms of the actual crimes and the kind of sending a message to the Russians and the way that he was actually originally picked up. He was in the Maldives, which apparently didn't have a formal extradition treaty with the US. I was a little unclear on that detail, but the Maldivian authorities let the US pick him up on their soil, and then it all gets rather complicated. And Krebs has got a bunch of screenshots of this guy, you know, doing the usual carding business on the internet. Whether or not it's 27 years worth of jail, but yeah, he does sound like he was involved in this top to bottom.
Krebs actually posted another piece that's pretty funny, which is, I guess he was bored because he got some spam and just decided to do his Krebs thing to the spam to find out where it came from, and he got some interesting results.
Yeah, he got spam, for like weight loss pills or something, and pulled the thread, and it turned out it actually came from a compromised mail account at like a defense contractor.
Oops.
And then, yeah, exactly, or a company owned by or affiliated with, and yeah, he did the thing and, kind of Krebsed. Krebs it all up and, talked to people who worked at the company and turned it into a thing. And, yeah, they've got egg on their face now.
Yeah. In some not-so-surprising news, some researchers have claimed that China is rolling the cybers against South Korea's missile defense program. But I got to be honest, if I was China, I would probably start rolling the cybers against South Korea's missile defense program, because that's going to make a bit of sense, right? That's going to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, now there's spear phishing emails targeting some of the organizations in South Korea that are involved with the deployment. And yeah, it's all the people you would normally expect. I think FireEye said it was APT-10, Stone Panda, that have been behind a bunch of the other stuff going on. So yeah, as you say, not at all even slightly surprising.
Yeah. Also, staying with news that is not so surprising, apparently the Fancy Bear Crew, the Russian government-backed Fancy Bear Crew, has been targeting Marine Le Pen's rival in the French election, Emmanuel Macron.
Yep, it's the same crew as we saw hit some of the organizations in the US election. So, yes, not even slightly surprising there either. People have been monitoring some of the domains being registered. There's kind of phishing domains being set up based on one of the examples listed in the motherboard piece is actually using OneDrive because the political organization uses Microsoft's Office 365. So, yeah, it's exactly the sort of things that you'd expect. No one's really saying whether they have otherwise succeeded, whether or not this campaign in particular was successful or other ones. But, yeah, it's sad that this is a thing we have to care about.
Well, yeah, and I don't think it's going to really trouble him too much because he has a whopping lead in the runoff, which is due next month. So I don't think it's going to cause him any drama. But it's been amazing seeing the speed with which those pro-Trump bots spun around and started spitting out pro-Marine Le Pen stuff. It's just incredible. Like, they don't even try to hide it.
Yeah, now we've got the UK election coming up as well, so they'll be pretty polished by then.
Neo-fascist fan art is really something, right? So you can see all the I'm with her and all the anti-Semitic sort of crazy, he's a Rothschild shit. Like, anyway, that's... 2017 and internet politics. So there we go. Oh, some bloke is suing Confide. Now, Confide is this app that's used by a whole bunch of Trump's people because it's, you know, super secret app and it costs $7 a month. And someone's suing them going, well, you know, now we sort of know that it's not so great. So I'm suing you because if I had known that it wasn't that great, I wouldn't have been giving you $7 a month.
Apparently, one of this guy's complaints is that when you use the desktop version of it, that it doesn't block screenshots like the iOS done does, which I guess he's never heard of carrying two phones and taking a photo of the other phone's screen, but yeah.
Or even a camera, or even a pen and paper.
Even a pen and paper, who knew?
Yeah, there you go. Andy Greenberg has written up a story about this so-called hack key thing, which is, you know, look, and this has been a long time coming for something like this to become very cheap and very available, but it's an $11 device that lets you pop open a whole bunch of cars.
Yeah, this is a device for doing replay attacks, like to extend the range of a car automatic door opening fob things. So one attacker stands by the car, one stands by the person in the shop, and they relay the challenge response back and forward because there isn't any kind of distance bounding on these things. A bit that's interesting, I guess, about this is A, the cost. They got it down to, you know, kind of $10, $11 per unit, but also because they aren't just like straight up recording the waveform and replaying it. They're actually doing like protocol, like analyzing the protocol, parsing it, and then passing just the actual protocol messages around at a high level, which means that there's way less traffic to move back and forth. So it's kind of faster and works more effectively, but is less generic. I guess that's the trade-off there. But yeah, seeing this kind of stuff turned into a tiny little handheld cheap device perhaps will prompt the vendors, and I suppose prompt the car manufacturers to push the upstream vendor, in this case NXP, to kind of come up with something that better that does have distance bounding.
Oh, now we were going to talk about this one last week, but we kind of ran out of time. But someone's figured out how to register Unicode domain names and then get them signed with, signed with Let's Encrypt and whatever, and just set up the most convincing looking phishing sites, basically. But this is actually pretty cool when you see it in action.
Yeah, this is a really well-polished example of kind of ID and homograph attacks where you register a domain that has, you know, for example, Greek or Cyrillic characters that look identical to Latin characters in the name and use that to kind of have a name that is looks the same as, in this case, apple.com, but is actually different in terms of the actual domain name involved. The bug that's being exploited here is actually in the way, in the rules that the browsers have, and specifically Firefox and Chrome have about when they will display the like encoded version, like the XN hyphen hyphen, you know, IDN domain name that's actually, you know, in the DNS, and when they'll display the sort of Unicode internationalized version. And there was a kind of a loophole in those rules that this particular example was exploiting, where if you have all of the characters from a single character set. So in this case, I think it was either Greek or Cyrillic. So Apple, all of the letters in Apple are from one alphabet. And that's one of the rules it uses to decide whether or not to display the real thing or not. Anyway, that was the bug they were exploiting, which is kind of a cunning edge case in how browsers display those domain names.
Yeah, so if you register like xn-80ak6aa92e.com and then you click on that, you know, with Chrome browser, it shows you apple.com. Which yeah, is just, so, you know, when you actually see it, it's just like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, the effectiveness is kind of dependent on the fonts you have configured. So like on one of my Linux on the desktop boxes, it was totally convincing. On the other one, it was kind of different because, you know, crazy fonts or whatever. But yeah, Chrome 58 actually shipped with a fix to the particular kind of loophole in how it figured out how to display IDN domain names. So yeah, if you want to try it, you do need to use a slightly older Chrome.
Aww.
It worked last week before we covered it, but didn't work this week when I went to test it before we recorded.
There we go. Now, next up, I want to talk about this story that's been unfolding for a couple of weeks, and we haven't previously had time to talk about it, but someone's been going a little bit Phineas Fisher and owning up some companies that make like consumer-grade malware and like spyware for mobile phones. They're called Retina X and FlexiSpy. So they've been owned sideways by some very Phineas Fisher style group called FlexiDie. Nice play on words there, guys. And yeah, it's interesting because what it has done is whipped up a lot of press coverage, particularly in Motherboard. Some great work there. Talking about the way these companies operate and the types of, you know, uses that this software has. And it's really shady stuff. And it's borderline impossible to feel sad that these guys got owned because it's just immoral. It is immoral what they do.
Yeah, I mean, the motherboard series has been really good at kind of talking through what the features are of this kind of, you know, and typically it's for mobile phone, kind of mobile phone spyware for people to use to kind of monitor their, you know, spouses or children or business partners or whatever. And yeah, you're right. It's just kind of, you know, unethical software. Yeah, there's been a couple of groups. One of them's called Leopard Boy and the Decepticons. They claim to be from Brazil, but, you know. Attribution whatevs. And another guy who has not provided a name, one owned FlexiSpy, one owned the company Retina X, and both of them have actually talked to Motherboard about how they went about it. And that's quite the hack against FlexiSpy was very Phineas Fisher, like in terms of the of the approach and the kind of cross disciplinary knowledge. And then they RM'd the entire FlexiSpy's operation, like vaped all the Windows boxes, all the Unix boxes, all the hosted stuff, the backups, the whole damn lot, burnt them all to the ground, redirected their website to Privacy International, and it was a pretty thorough owning, using the sorts of just good old-fashioned hacking. It's a great write-up. There's a text file and paste bin from Mr. Leopard Boy describing the process. And then the other one on Retina X is even better in a way, because it's just so mind-numbingly, face-palmingly, head-smackingly stupid, which is that they grabbed the mobile app that you install when you install the spyware product, reversed out the Java, found the API keys for the place where they store the data they're exfilling off the phones. And one of the features was that it would take screenshots of the device every 2 minutes and upload them to this, you know, kind of like cloud service thingy. Anyway, so the hacker uses the API keys to dump all the pictures out of that, and then finds the developers testing their own product, getting screenshotted every 2 minutes, rummages through that until he finds a screenshot of the developer reading credentials.txt, finds the admin password, logs in, done. What? Mm. I mean, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
It's a nice caper, isn't it? Now, look, I'm not sure where these companies are based, but, you know, certainly if they were based in the United States, I would expect that it would be entirely reasonable for the Department of Justice to throw some charges at them, much in the same way that charges were thrown at that guy recently for making, you know, what is essentially a rat, you know, a remote access Trojan, because that's what they're selling. And they're selling it to, you know, most of the people who are buying this are like spouses who want to spy on their partners. And that is a crime. So I just think, you know, you would be very brave to be operating a company like this, certainly in the United States, because it would seem that it would be a, you know, politically, it would be a very popular thing to do to prosecute a company like this for selling these types of tools, right?
Well, yeah, you would. I mean, you, certainly if it isn't, you know, in some way illegal to do this, then it damn well ought to be. At very minimum, Mr. Leopard Boy has said that he is going to make it his business to take out everybody else in this industry and continue to do so. So best watch out.
Turning our attention to ThreatPost now, and apparently Zimperium is going to start publishing exploits for patched Android bugs, to which I've got to ask, why? That seems like a very 2001 marketing move. Like, what's the go?
Well, I mean, their assertion is that this is to push the phones, phone vendors and carriers into publishing fixes or pushing updates out faster, because they
do so. Well, it worked in 2001 for Windows, right?
So, well, yeah, you know, and maybe it will work. You know, whether it is marketing or whether it is actually sort of, you know, genuine public good, and you know, it may well actually be, you know, that having exploits out there that you can point to will force some of the more rubbish vendors and carriers to, you know, to act a little bit faster. But I think mostly all that's going to happen is people are just going to get their boxes, you know, get their phones owned more.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my take as well, right? So, because I think it's not like you're putting pressure on one central company like Microsoft. Do you know what I mean? It's that the problem is the distributed nature of the patch ecosystem for Android. So, yeah, let's see. We like mayhem. We can report on mayhem. So that's going to be interesting. There is a Squirrel Mail RCE with no patch.
What year is it? So Squirrel Mail is a webmail package that, you know, has to be at least 15 years old now, and I guess is probably pretty much abandoned. A couple of people found some remote code exec bugs and it reported it to the maintainers and basically just haven't got a response. So, I mean,
I may have done some hobby fingerprinting on certain governments and found their Squirrel Mail logins not so long ago, Adam, so you would be surprised. You would be surprised where it pops up. But yeah, that was a little while ago. That was a few years ago. But still, man, I'm guessing it's around, you know?
I used to work for open source systems integrator where we sold people Squirrel Mail boxes. So yeah, that definitely did get around. It was, it was a good webmail package in the year 2004 AD. But yeah. That is not the year that we are in anymore.
That is not the case any longer. Oh, and we love to talk about a cold fusion patch because it's sort of like, Band-Aid on the gaping wound. But Adobe has apparently, applied a fix that resolves some cross-site scripting bugs in ColdFusion and some Java deserialization bugs. Were they interesting ones?
Yeah, I mean, this is like Java deserialization is bad news. I mean, that's code exec, and we've seen this set of bugs exploit VMware, exploit Atlassian Jira, and it's just kind of taken Adobe, some months longer to get around to rolling out this particular patch. But yeah, the the embedded open source Java guts. Of struts and that kind of thing that are in so many products are just, they're a wonderful gift to us hackers because, it takes ages for anyone to get anything fixed. And ColdFusion being remote code exec via this is just, one more of those.
Yeah, it is. But we kid the ColdFusion, we had to mention that. All right, Adam, that is it for this week's news. Now, next week, it's funny because Adam reached out to me and he said, oh, I can't do next Wednesday, before I had a chance to reach out to him and say, oh, Adam, I can't do next Wednesday. So we're going to record on Thursday next week in Australia, New Zealand time. So the show will be a day late next week. But yes, my friend, I will talk to you then.
Yes, hopefully the world will not have entirely burnt down by then. And if it hasn't, we will talk about it.
That was Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Susan Hennessy. Susan is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and also the managing editor at Lawfare. She was formerly an attorney for the National Security Agency, and she focuses primarily on national security issues related to cybersecurity and surveillance. So I thought she would be the perfect person to talk to about all these rumors doing the rounds that the US is getting serious about preparing charges against Julian Assange. Now, depending on who you ask, you get one of two reactions when you discuss this with people. The first reaction is, great, screw that guy. And the second is, OMG, press freedom. And honestly, I have a foot in both camps. On one hand, I think Julian Assange's actions and politics are juvenile, naive, and frankly, a tad vile. But on the other hand, I'm a journalist, aren't I? So, there is that. Now, look, some people can't see the press freedom angle on this stuff because they loathe Assange and WikiLeaks so much. So before we kick off this interview, let me describe a scenario to you. I'm an American journalist. I get contacted by a foreign intelligence service, and that service leaks documents to me that expose widespread government corruption and other wrongdoing. The Foreign Intelligence Service has stolen these classified documents and is leaking them to me to damage the US government, but the information really is genuinely in the public interest. Now, of course, any good journalist is going to publish those documents. But if Assange is successfully prosecuted under the Espionage Act for taking receipt of stolen classified information and then publishing it, what's to stop them coming after me as an American journalist in that scenario? Defining what journalism actually is actually pretty hard. And while I'm not a lawyer, the Espionage Act does seem pretty vague in a pretty alarming way, to be frank. So on the surface, I would certainly feel a little bit uncomfortable seeing the Espionage Act used to give Julian Assange a whack across the head as much as he deserves it. But we may be jumping the gun a bit when it comes to freaking out about all of this. As Susan Hennessy explains, future charges may be completely unrelated to the Espionage Act. Remember how Julian Assange offered to help Manning crack password hashes? And you may have heard me talk about that a few times. Yep, well, that might not have been such a great idea. Here's Susan Hennessy.
Yeah, so anytime there's classified information, people sort of always go to the Espionage Act, and it's been sort of a big unsettled question of the law. And so I think it's natural that that's where people's minds go. I do think it's probably more likely that we would see things like CFAA charges, or even, there's a regular statute of just theft of federal property, and you can conspire with somebody in order to commit those crimes. And so I do think that it's more likely we would see something like that. I also agree, you know, it's probably less concerning for journalists because there really is sort of a divide between being a journalist who receives information and then publishes what is, you know, true and newsworthy within that that information versus actually sort of soliciting or criminally conspiring in order to obtain it.
Well, soliciting information is something that a regular journalist will do, right? I mean, that is something they will do. But what they won't do is say, oh, yeah, fling me a password hash and I'll crack it for you. We've got rainbow tables for that, which is what Julian Assange is alleged to have done in the case of Manning. And that's, you know, I don't know. It's funny, actually, because a lot of people don't know that. I think it's something that's becoming more widely known now. But it is something that when I've pointed out to a few journalists, they're like, whoa, you know, they would never do that in a pink fit.
Right. So I think that the discomfort here is that we're starting to get into questions of degree. So if we can agree that is clearly over the line of either journalistic ethics or is clearly over the line of the law, everyone might sort of be comfortable with that form of prosecution. But as you mentioned, journalists actually do solicit information. And so the worry is that if you had a journalist who is saying, hey, you know, they had a source and a source that had been discussing things with them and they said, hey, you know, maybe you could get me some proof of this, or maybe you could obtain these particular type of records. You know, if the source was, for example, a federal employee that didn't have access to those records, right? They had to go and obtain them in a way that ran afoul of the theft of federal property statutes. You know, that's we start getting into areas in which journalists could inadvertently violate the law, right? And we start sort of talking about a spectrum. That's not to say that we should consider everything sort of off limits, but I think it is a reason why it's important that as we shift policy, we be really, really thoughtful about why and how we're doing it, because it can become a slippery slope here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Now, I mean, one of the things that alarms me most, perhaps, is that, you know, I have no love for WikiLeaks and the way that it conducts itself. But when I try to break down its activities into some sort of legal definition, it becomes very quickly almost completely indistinguishable from work that I've done and work that other people I know have done. So the CFAA thing is nice, in that it is such an outlier and so outside the scope of regular media work that I don't think it's going to ruffle too many feathers. But once you start getting onto this thing of like, you know, okay, so Assange was handling Manning. If you want to use the language of espionage, he was acting as a handler. But I mean, that's a very typical relationship between a journalist and a source, right? How would you even start to pin down some sort of legal difference between what Assange did with Manning and what I might do with someone I know who works in a government department who's exposing genuine wrongdoing?
Yeah, so look, it obviously is challenging, or it's always been challenging, sort of drawing the line between whistleblowing and criminal conduct. That's been a challenge for the government. It's obviously been a huge issue that's arisen a lot in the conversation surrounding Edward Snowden's disclosures. You know, so this has always been an area, the source of some discomfort. You know, that said, it's... I have sort of a little bit of an unusual view in that I actually don't think that WikiLeaks is journalism. I think occasionally it engages in journalism, maybe sort of as an incidental or accidental matter.
No. I mean, Susan, I don't think it's journalism either. Right? Like, don't get me wrong. I do not think it's journalism, but I'm wondering how you pin that down from a legal sense when you look at their day-to-day activities, which is soliciting information from people that they probably shouldn't be exposing and then publishing it. I mean, that's the bread and butter. That is the life force of a functioning media. So, you know, while I recognize that, yeah, I don't consider WikiLeaks really to be a news organization, their activities, certainly the activities that someone would seek to prosecute them for, are indistinguishable from those of genuine news organizations.
I think that you've hit on an important point, and that's that even though one might not consider WikiLeaks journalism, these types of prosecutions are still potentially alarming because it's so difficult to sort of disentangle draw really clean lines. You know, there is a really important concept in the law, and I think is the operative distinction here, and that's the question of motive or intent. So in all kinds of U.S. U.S. laws or U.S. criminal prosecutions, you have to prove mens rea, the guilty mind. You have to prove that somebody did something with a particular intention. And that really is part of it's certainly within the espionage statutes, and it's within lots of different elements of criminal law. So whenever you think about, that is potentially the operative difference between an organization like WikiLeaks and organizations that most people would agree engage in genuine journalism. So I do think that there is the legal concept in terms of, what exactly is the difference? And under the law, how would we handle this? Well, you would set forth a requirement that they do something with a particular mental state, and then the government would have to prove its burden by probable cause. The difficulty here is that this is an area in which we don't want the government to ever be over-inclusive. The values of a free press and of the First Amendment are so important, but this is a case in which we want to err on the side of under prosecution, on letting people who maybe should be prosecuted off the hook, just because the risks of things sort of moving in the other direction and genuine journalists being prosecuted is so corrosive to our really, really deeply cherished values. So I think that sort of that puts WikiLeaks in the present situation in a little bit of an uncomfortable position, because there is a decent legal argument here, and there actually is maybe a decent sort of ethical argument. That said, the risks of impinging on other forms of journalism are such that I just, as sort of a cost-benefit measure, this really doesn't seem like something we want any administration, but in particular the Trump administration, to be engaging in.
I bounced a couple of emails back and forth with about this, actually. And, it's his feeling that there might be an internal battle playing out at the moment, with Jeff Sessions pushing for a sweeping Espionage Act charge, but the sort of rusted on career folks at DOJ kind of resisting that. So perhaps the career people want to find some sort of highly fact-specific charge, like something around the CFAA or something like that, that isn't so broad and can be distinguished from, the situations that most journalists find themselves in. But, the problem is perhaps those facts aren't readily at hand. Would you think that perhaps that internal struggle is real?
Sure. I mean, this is one of the challenges of this administration in lots of different contexts, and also here. We're dealing with news reports that are sort of unconfirmed rumors, essentially. So ordinarily, whenever we're trying to evaluate a policy or a decision to seek prosecution, we have the government's theory of the case is sort of laid out in an indictment. They've given us lots and lots of specifics. Here we have sort of comments from CIA Director Mike Pompeo about that time has ended, and no more that we're going to allow WikiLeaks to cloak themselves in the First Amendment in order to do us harm. And then we have sort of these rumors essentially about what the Justice Department might be considering. I think it's entirely plausible that there would be an internal struggle. I think it would be pretty surprising if there wasn't a significant internal struggle over a decision this controversial and this consequential. That said, we're once again in the position of kind of reading the tea leaves here, because the administration hasn't come forward, the Justice Department hasn't come forward to really articulate what its thinking is here. That is especially dangerous around sort of prosecutions of press freedoms, because to the extent that they decide that this is a case that they want to seek prosecution for, the way to mitigate any potential harms or collateral harms is going to be really being really, really clear about why they view this as different from other forms of journalism, and how exactly the sort of the theory of the case and the factual distinction here is such that people who are engaged in actual protected First Amendment activities shouldn't be alarmed, right? That they should continue to engage in that kind of reporting.
When it comes to the jurisdictional issues involved, now I imagine, you know, there's a difference between intelligence and evidence, right? I mean, evidence is used to prosecute a specific criminal act. You know, intelligence is often gathered under different types of warrants or maybe without a warrant at all. You know, would there be this issue, do you think, if they do have the goods on Assange, particularly in terms of, you know, investigating the extent to which he's involved with certain foreign intelligence services? You would imagine, though, that that evidence isn't something that, or intelligence or evidence, wouldn't really be something that DOJ or NSA or bloody anyone would really want to see in an open court.
Right. So we do have a law to handle that. It's called CIPA, the Classified Information Procedures Act. So that's the way that the government is able to submit classified evidence in a prosecution. It's done ex camera, just before a judge. So there is ways to do this. And the other thing is it really
hang on,
does
hang on.
Depend
so you're
on
talking
the-
about like closed court. I mean, that's going to go down a treat with, you know, Assange's rusted on fan base, right? Like that's when the Alex Joneses of the world, their heads explode.
Yes, so certainly it will be controversial. That said, it's something that's used all the time in national security prosecution. So while I'm sure it'll get the conspiracy theorists going, there are procedures in place in order to balance the government's need for secrecy with the rights of the defendant. And there are a number of sort of legal standards and protections where we work out those precise questions of what can be said in open court versus what can be said before the judge, what the government is obligated to disclose. You know, the relevant thing here is to the extent that this prosecution would rest on essentially the activity of Chelsea Manning, you know, the government has already gone through a sort of a dress rehearsal here in the original Manning prosecution. And so this is one of those somewhat unusual areas in which to the extent that there was a need to prove only the collusion element of sort of that Manning piece, that might not run afoul of as much classified information as, you know, were they starting from scratch.
It's my feeling too, Susan, that should Chelsea Manning choose to cooperate in any move against Assange, then Assange is, if you'll excuse my French, he's f***ed. Is that an assessment that you would agree with?
Sure. So Chelsea Manning's sentence has already been commuted, and so she does not have any sort of incentives. There's no sort of coercive incentives here for her to testify if she didn't decide to.
Although, I mean, look, from if you look at Manning's politics, though, you know, I can't imagine that she would be terribly approving of the recent directions that that WikiLeaks has taken. I mean, I would have thought that would be motivation.
I have no idea how she would feel on this. Feel about this. So certainly, if you had sort of a killer cooperating witness who was going to come forward and you know, provide lots and lots of details, that would be a very, very bad news for Julian Assange. I don't think that the government would actually even need that kind of help. In part because of the evidence that you referenced earlier, right? There's lots and lots known in terms of what occurred in terms of the assistance and direction provided to Manning originally. The area in which new evidence might become relevant is if the government's theory of the case rests on Assange being that non-state hostile intelligence service that Pompeo was talking about, or something related to sort of his relationship to the Russian government. That's the point at which we're going to be talking about new classified information. So, you know, the sort of what gets said in open court will become more contested or difficult for the government, and that also might be the place in which sort of things like witnesses bringing new information might be more relevant or important.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, the thinking is, though, that you know, the Manning leaks predate Julian's involvement with certain foreign services, right? So that sort of gets interesting. Look, it's also my feeling, and tell me what you think of this, it's also my feeling that DOJ had basically forgotten about him, right? Like, so there was this big flurry of activity, and then people move on with their lives and with their careers because a fair bit of time had passed. So more or less, Julian Assange was just disappearing, you know, becoming less and less relevant. He was going to one day return to Australia and do the Writers' Festival circuit, being very annoying, right? So that was his destiny. And then the DNC leaks happened. I mean, that sort of, my feeling is that that's what's led to, you know, the charges may be coming out of a desk drawer somewhere. Is that your feeling as well?
I don't know. I can't sort of say what the motivation here for DOJ. You know, clearly there is a newfound examination of the role that these kinds of organizational doxing or nation-state hacking has on democracies, right? We've seen in the past election cycle the really, really substantial consequences that that can have, and certainly we're seeing that activity already occurring, you know, in our allies abroad. So I think that there is an increased appetite to come up with some form of stronger deterrence. Going after Assange might be a way to signal a stronger posture towards this activity moving forward. I certainly think that there was a perception that the Obama administration was too timid here or too afraid of infringing on things like press freedom, and therefore was sort of insufficiently aggressive in countering this kinds of activity. So, you know, to the extent that the current administration has different instincts about that and wants to send a different signal to these organizations, I don't know that Assange would have just been forgotten about. That said, I think, you know, but for the new focus on this kind of sort of nation state hacking and just in a cyber-enabled information warfare in general, and the role that distribution platforms like WikiLeaks play.
And interestingly enough, you know, this entire conversation is focused on the assumption, has taken place under the assumption that charges would stem from the SIPRNet Manning leaks, when really we could be looking at a whole batch of new stuff related to the DNC leaks in Podesta.
Sure. So there certainly wasn't any indication that WikiLeaks was involved in the actual hacks. And to the extent that this were now getting into just the receipt of the information, then I think that gets us back into the territory of it being more of an area that might overlap with real or traditional journalism in a way that might get less comfortable for us.
But unfortunately, again, it depends, right? Because then if he's on the phone or, you know, communicating, probably not on the phone, but if he's communicating then with, you know, US political operatives and coordinating activities between foreign intelligence services and US-based political operatives, then, you know, maybe an espionage charge. I don't know. Maybe it looks reasonable, but Susan Hennessy, that's all we're going to have time for. It's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to have you on the show again in the future.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Susan Hennessy there. And yeah, I'll be really curious to hear what Manning has to say if she decides to say anything publicly, because I can't imagine that the pacifist trans woman is going to be a huge fan of Assange. Now he's a proxy for, you know, Vladimir Putin and by extension Bashar al-Assad. I mean, between the two of them, they're homophobic, transphobic and genocidal. So, you know, that's just a wild guess on my part. So, yeah, we'll see what happens there. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Senatas. Senatas makes Layer 2 encryption equipment, and these days, Senatas is getting pretty hip to contemporary networking technology. They're currently doing some work with Adva Optical Networks in integrating Senatas encryption tech into software-defined telco services. Now, Adva's Senior Director of Service and Solution Architecture, Scott Vandiver, is actually in Australia at the moment putting the final touches on a partnership with Senatas that will let customers do some pretty funky stuff in terms of rolling software-defined networks that are Layer 2 encrypted, which is super nice when you actually want to encrypt your control plane as well as your actual, as well as your actual data. Adva's Scott Vandiver and Senatas CTO Julian Fay joined me via Skype for this interview, and here's what they said.
So in telco today, the drive is really to take advantage of more cost-effective, high-availability services. So using something called SD-WAN or software-defined WAN technologies that are out there in order to mix and match both your closed circuit or private circuit MPLS type services, but to pair those with much larger available throughput services like DOCSIS or GPON or 3GPP types of services for that are public, and to securely encrypt traffic across those public networks so that you have a hybrid of public and private networks working together to provide a fully secure and fully available service to your enterprise customers for a much more cost-effective and more available type of dynamic service. And that coupled with virtualized cloud services is something that Ava and Cenitas are working together to be able to provide.
Well, that's where it gets interesting, right? Because you're not just talking about point-to-point through a telco network anymore, are you? You're talking about multiple edges and, you know, the whole concept of like how private do you want to be? How many endpoints do you want to be sort of part of this virtual network? I mean, it starts getting pretty complicated, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely. When you're talking about availability of services and you may have a much lower bandwidth MPLS type of circuit that's provided by the telco, but even the telcos now are looking at providing the last mile across a public circuit. So they may, for places that are looking for wide distribution across a very diverse type of topology. If you look at retail type of applications for malls and what's commonly referred to as a store in the box type of service, where that last mile may be provided across GPON or DOCSIS or something, and the telco is actually pushing for the retail location to do that. You have to have a certain level of encryption and security provided for that last mile that has never been done before, where
it's been done, but it's just been done like higher up in the OSI stack, you know, the OSI model, right? So what is actually driving that trend down towards lower and, you know, the hideously outdated and awful OSI model? Like, why is it that people are more interested in doing this at like layer two these days? Is there genuine customer demand there?
There is. I mean, efficiency is one, and two, being able to drive that into a much more ubiquitous type of architecture so that they can do this across a multitude of different delivery services so that it's pretty much the same management infrastructure winds up appearing the same at the cloud at a cloud layer for the end customer, but yet the services delivered is the same across several different types of delivery services.
Now, Julian, obviously, you know, the reason we're speaking with Scott in one of your sponsored segments is, I'm guessing the reason is because Cenitas is working pretty closely with Adva on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I have talked before, Patrick, about this change from, you know, predominantly hardware-based encryption models into one where there's an increasing demand for software virtual appliances, you know, as part of NFV, network function virtualization, which, you know, to be frank, is a challenging change for an organization such as us, which has its heritage in hardware tamper-proof boxes. But we recognize the requirement and the need in this area, but it really only makes sense for us, in fact, it's probably only really possible for us to address this market by working with an organization such as Adva, which does provide the ecosystem and the infrastructure in which a virtual encryptor such as ours can be deployed at scale. You know, in most of our customer networks today, we're talking about hundreds, not thousands of instances of encryption devices. The kind of scale that these deployments that Scott has mentioned really does get up into the multi-thousands. So the challenge there is how do you securely deploy and instantiate, say, 10,000 virtual encryptors, make sure all the keys are unique and secure between all those devices, and are orchestrated in such a way that it's basically a zero-touch deployment. So that's
Where are these virtual encryptors actually running? Where do they live, and what's the hardware that they're running on?
Right. So when you're talking about this type of service, you want to be able to run those encryptors as close to the customer as possible, because you don't want the traffic leaving the customer prem and traveling in the clear, especially across public networks. So in order to take advantage of public networks and transporting customer traffic across the internet, you need to be able to start that encryption at the customer prem. So the service that Adva has developed, these micro cloud services, are actually running down at the customer prem. So we deploy a solution called Ensemble that allows us to take advantage of OpenStack and spin up the Cenitas VNF, the virtual network function, which is the encryptor, down at the customer prem. So that traffic, as it's leaving the customer perimeter, is encrypted in an extremely efficient way, so that we can then pass that traffic up to the central office or into data centers, where it would then be de-encrypted and go about the path that it needs to, whether it's point of sale type of transaction data or inventory data or regular company business traffic, you know, that's taken advantage of the cost-efficient public services, you know, but remaining it is secure and encrypted from these virtual encryptors that are running at the customer prem.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But what are they running on at the customer prem?
White box Intel-based services. So our Ensemble solution takes a standard white box server, whether a Dell or Hewlett-Packard or Advantech type of box, and we provide the enablement environment, the operationalization environment for OpenStack and our own software called Connector that's running there that provides the virtualization environment to manage.
You're more or less connecting the Senatas component into the existing SDN box that you're putting at a customer premises, right? Is that kind of right?
Yes. So SDN from an SDN and NFV or VNF sort of world. Yes.
I think one of the changes, Patrick, here is that because this hybrid SDN network environment really takes advantage of both public and private networks, you have this hybrid environment. Encryption is no longer just a sort of bolt-on. I might or might not have some sort of IPsec tunnel over my enterprise network. It's kind of essential and critical to the whole model, because not only do you have to encrypt the customer data, you've also got to encrypt the control plane as well that's deploying these virtualized environments. Yep. So it becomes sort of systemic, really built into the overall solution. It's not just a bolt-on like it used to be.
So what sort of organizations are actually going for this right now? Like what are some companies that you've sort of rigged this up for in the last few months?
So mostly so this is a whole new world. There's been a lot of conversations about virtual CPE, virtual custom premise edge, software-defined WAN, probably for the last 2 or 3 years.
Yep.
A lot of the standards around this are still emerging. I mean, Etsy has standards around VNF. There are other competing standards. But I think what we're seeing collectively between Adva and Senatas over the last 9 months is that we're starting to get real traction with real custom deployments who need this kind of environment. And just to be clear, we're still building out this capability. That's why Scott is here this week in Australia. We're building out this capability. But Scott can tell you that they are getting significant interest and real business with telcos for this kind of SD-WAN or smart WAN environment.
Right. So within the broader telco environments, the SD-WAN, virtualized SD-WAN environment is a very hot topic. With most carriers across the world, we have opportunities that we're working on and trials and POCs that are running in pretty much every region that you could name in Latin America, North America, Europe, and Asia. It's a central force where the telcos are trying to get out ahead of the enterprise environments, where the enterprise knows that they can take advantage of these more cost-effective services if they can add managed encryption and managed hybrid WAN types of functions with traffic classification and traffic steering to build much more cost-effective network environments. So the telcos are really driving to get out there to offer this as a service to the enterprises, and it's a major driving force right now. And I think that it's going to be the gateway drug that we see for tipping the networks, the enterprises, and the carriers alike into a much larger NFV world.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to chatting about a couple of local case studies with you in the future, Julian. But Scott and Julian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Patrick. Cheers.
Thank you.
That was Scott Vandiver and Julian Fay there. Big thanks to Senatas Security for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. You can check them out at senatas.com. I have linked through to an ad for announcement about its Ensemble Harmony ecosystem in this week's show notes too, in case that floats your boat and you want a little bit more information. And that's it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget, we will be a day late next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.